This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by one of our regular guests, Matt Wolf. Matt's a senior leader and in charge of valuations at RSM. RSM is the leading sort of firm in the world in sort of advising private equity funds in the mid-market, quality of earnings, due diligence, sell side. They just grew up in the mid-market. Now they work with mega funds as well. Matt, talk to us today about what trends are you following today in the private equity world? What's on your guys' minds?
Yeah, we don't have a conversation today that doesn't lend itself or somehow end up on labor supply and labor shortage issues across sectors, across ecosystems. The other trend that we're watching and trying to pay attention to is monetary policy, right? What will happen? Will be a new Fed chair? Will that change perhaps the pace of, probably not tapering, but interest rate increases? What might that mean for deal making environment? Those two are top of mind this week for sure.
When you talk about monetary policy, I think most people in the overall economic community, you know, they at least are quite pleased with Chairman Powell's work. And again, you have to remember Chairman Powell was a Republican by background. He's appointed originally by Barack Obama. He became Fed chairman under President Trump. You couldn't get two more different leaders to appoint somebody, at least two different political perspectives. Now, he's taking flack on the far left for I'm not sure what reason exactly, maybe because he was appointed by Trump as a chairperson, or because he's not been as, you know, there's a movement on the left that the Fed chairman should be very involved in climate discussions and some other social justice issues. Where is the thinking on this? Is he actually going to be replaced? Are they actually, I know they're down to two candidates, him and somebody else. Is Biden actually going to pull the trigger based on the push of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders to get rid of Powell? Is that going to happen? Or what's your sense of what's going to happen here?
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I would have said, "Nah, I think he'll stay. Things seem fine." I think the real impetus for a potential change, at least from my perspective, are the recent headline inflation prints. I think the current administration is under a lot of pressure for increased pricing, particularly with respect to gas, and we've seen the U.S. pressure other countries to release more reserves. China is doing so. But I think that is feeding into this discussion of, okay, well, we had a 6.2% headline inflation print. We need to do something with the Fed chair, even though it's just purely political, right? I mean, monetary policy can't solve the underlying factors influencing inflation as it's measured by that headline number, but I think there's a political push to be seen as doing something about inflation.
But isn't it true? I mean, he's gone slow on raising rates based on unemployment rates, and the employment rates are still at the 4-something% rate, which we all think of as about equilibrium. That's about as you can't go much lower than 4% or so, 4.6. You can get down to 3 or so without there being virtually no unemployment. But he's been following the social justice goal. It has been defined by really the left of we're going to really tie interest rates to two different things. One, getting minority unemployment significantly down further. That's been one goal. And two, getting the average of longer term inflation down to 2%, not just the 1 year pop up in it. And that's unclear as to where that's at. And then there's been this discussion as well of, so there's two big goals they've talked about, getting long term average inflation. Once that creeps above 2%, they're going to raise rates. And second is getting minority unemployment way down, not just looking at regular unemployment. And then there's this issue of how do you sort of, he's been sort of to the perspective of myself, who I think of as a centrist, you know, voted for different parties for different things at different times. He seems to have tried hard to meet the social justice goal of not looking at just employment, building minority employment, which many of us don't even know if interest rates really have much to do with it or not. But so talk a little bit about that and how you how this what's going to happen, I guess. Is he not going to get – is he going to get replaced? And then if they replace him with somebody who's you know, are they going to have the 50-plus votes to appoint a new person? I guess maybe they will, because they got 50 Democrats in the Senate, as long as the person's, you know, is acceptable to the Manchins and the Sinemas in the world. I mean, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, historically, the Federal Reserve chair has not been terribly contested, get pretty much bipartisan support through for whoever makes it through that process. Although, like so many other conventions in Washington, we've seen that erode over previous cycles. I think if they were to, you know, proffer a different candidate, you know, he or she probably wouldn't go through. But, you know, what I guess what I focus on and what I'm watching in this process, and you mentioned it earlier, is this sort of idea that exists in the political sphere that monetary policy is a tool for alleviating some of these social issues. And certainly, I think from an investor perspective, from a business perspective, an excess minority unemployment rate, that is a bad thing, right? We want everybody who is looking for a job to be able to find a job that will only create more wealth for everybody. So it certainly is, it's a bipartisan issue. It's just not one I don't think monetary policy can solve. It's more fiscal policy, but, you know, fiscal policy is beholden to voters, politics, and the election process, whereas monetary policy is controlled by a political appointee. And that's why I think we're getting the focus on Chair Powell that may be undeserved.
No, it's really fascinating, because what's happened is the Fed office, has not been that politicized. And you've had this other thing going on in D.C. where at least there's a perspective that the White House has been trying to play down inflation for a while, because inflation being up makes it harder to pass $2 trillion, $1.3.5 trillion spending bills, because people are concerned that would add to inflation. So the White House and Janet Yellen have pushed for a while to say that, you know, there's not that much inflation. And of course, at some point, all of us see what's out there, is we're at the pump, we're at the gas tanks, we're getting our heating bills, and we could see inflation. And so it's a really fascinating set of political narratives that seem to be driving a lot of this. And I don't mean to be so political, but it's just a fascinating set of things that are driving something that, you know, I think that, like, Powell, like Greenspan, probably left interest rates too low for too long, and has led to this, you know, extremely high valuations of assets, has led to some challenges in the housing market, taking it out of equilibrium and some other things. But there are a lot of supply demand things, the chip shortages and so forth, that really have very little bearing. The Fed has very little bearing on some of the things that are really driving this logjam at our ports. Presumably, has very little to do asset inflation, the stock market, real estate. That has to do with interest rates. A lot of these other things have nothing to do with interest rates. I mean, you could raise rates, and it's going to have very little impact on oil and gas supplies. That's a really different issue of us deciding that we're moving away from fossil fuels. It's having a big impact there.
Absolutely, and that's why, as we talk about regularly, it's so important to go below the headline and really understand what's going on. Yeah, because raising interest rates isn't going to change the zoning laws in Santa Monica to allow, you know, for stacking higher containers so that we can get better throughput of ships there, right? I mean, this inflation has caused a large part of it is because we basically shut down the global economy, which was largely a just-in-time economy. A lot of things were furloughed, easy to shut down, difficult to reopen, especially as American households are sitting on an extra $1.5 trillion of household net worth that they're trying desperately to spend because they'd saved it over the pandemic. And, you know, we just have to work itself out a little bit, and monetary policy won't fix that.
But, but this is a fascinating complication of monetary policy. The other thing is, as much as I believe that interest rates probably should creep back up a little bit, just it makes retirees who are savers a lot easier to make things work because they can make some money off of their safer investments. All of us, that the 50+% of us that invest in the stock market own real estate, which you think of it in America as those that have capital, have obviously loved these run-ups in stock prices.
Yeah, and that's the other thing to measure too, and that's a really good point, right? Is in, you know, we've seen these large inflation prints, which are year-over-year estimates, so there's all sorts of issues with that. But even if you take the 6.2% at face value, I mean, year-to-date, the stock market's still up 23-24%. So, you know, if you're invested in stocks, which probably means you were already relatively insulated from inflationary pressures anyway, you're doing pretty well. If not, you're probably feeling the hurt a little more.
Right. If you're the other 40% of the economy that essentially doesn't own a house and has no little, very little stock exposure, inflation just is a killer because your job wages aren't going up as fast as inflation. You don't have the savings to sort of like make up for this to be like, right, if you're an investor, and most of us don't have all of our money in the market, but if the S&P is up 24-25% this year, you've outpaced inflation and you feel smart, you feel good, et cetera. It is a fascinating set of figures. Now, on the private equity side, it seems like still piling money into deals, still raising funds well. But are they having a harder time finding deals? Is the ability to find deals they want to do slowing down one bit?
You know, I think anecdotally, yes. And we've seen that in some of the sector data, right? Some subsectors, we've seen activity slow a little bit. I still think in general, we're going to see a lot of activity pulled forward into the fourth quarter of this year that we might have otherwise seen early in 2022, just as sellers and other investors get concerned about potential changes to the capital gains rate. But I've seen it slow a little bit. I think there's still, you know, plenty of companies to or invest in assets to purchase. It's just coming down to a question of quality. And also, you know, a lot of investors and funds have kind of went on a bit of a binge and are now maybe focusing a little bit more on optimizing and running portfolio and a little less on sourcing new deals, especially middle market funds that, you know, have more limited bandwidth to do both at the same time. But it's still an elevated deal activity, but we are seeing in some areas that it is starting to slow a bit.
And to that point, like I see in at least a few of the funds that we're invested in, that we're not getting the capital calls as quickly and so forth, because they're not, it didn't seem putting the money to work as quickly. Is that a trend that's going to be the case? Is there so much money chasing deals that people aren't able to put it to work as quickly as they otherwise could?
Yeah, I think so. It's going to be really interesting though, right? I mean, there's so much more money, and this is something that we really try to dig into and find data on, and it's difficult to measure, right? Which is increasing faster, the demand for companies and assets or the supply of investable companies and assets? And it's a really difficult thing to measure. I think we're getting closer to an equilibrium. That demand is still very high, but the supply is starting to decrease somewhat. I think we're also seeing that too, as evidenced by the size of financing rounds or implied valuations and, you know, for like venture capital investments, and then also buyout multiples. You know, we're seeing maybe the deal volume is slowing a little bit, but the value, the dollars invested are still increasing because there is just so much money chasing those deals that the ones you can find, you might pay a little bit more than you would have 2 years ago, but, you know, at least you found an investable company that's willing to do a deal with you?
No, it's a fascinating perspective. And there's now these public options to invest in private equity funds. Like you can invest in Blackstone, KKR, they're publicly traded and the returns have been phenomenal this year. Do people that invest in private equity funds or with private equity funds, you know, accredited investors, et cetera, you know, will there be more of an interest in people just putting some of their money with those funds, those companies, like almost investing like in a Goldman versus just the stock market? Will there be more of that as we go forward? Or is there any sense of that? Is that just a question that's too far off the reservation for this discussion?
You know, there's a wide range of thought on this topic. And, you know, part of it gets down to one of the fundamental questions in finance, which is, will investors pay for diversifiable risk? You know, so will they pay to invest in Blackstone that has a portfolio of other companies when that investor could get similar exposure through an ETF, for example, I think is one of the critical finance questions there. But of course, it gets much more nuanced, right? Because Blackstone is investing in companies that investor probably couldn't create the portfolio of. So that's the value proposition of the public private equity funds. And I think, you know, we've seen, at least on the institutional side, was a story a couple days ago, right? CalPERS taking on debt to invest in more alternative assets to try to seek that stated return that they're making, right? So, you know, if institutional investors are increasing their allocation to private equity, it seems pretty safe to say that the rest of, you know, other accredited investors, other smaller investors will likely follow suit. But it is kind of a fundamental finance question, investment question.
But truly a fascinating question, because you saw, you know, CalPERS did exactly the following. They basically said they've got to get the returns higher. They need to seek what they call alpha. They can't just do it through publicly traded things. So they're raising their allocation of private equity from 8% to 13%, which for CalPERS, which is almost a $500 billion state pension fund, the largest in the country, that's $25 billion more that they're going to put into private equity. They also said they're going to put an allocation into private debt. And then they said something else that scares individual investors, that they would borrow $25 billion to try and invest it at higher returns. So hopefully they can get lower borrowing rates, invest it. And their whole goal is to get they'll get things in a 20-year timeline to try and get things from a 6.2% annualized return to a 7% annualized return and get closer to beating their obligations. I found it to be fascinating to watch what they're doing. You know, as an individual investor who has some private equity exposure, it just makes you think like, oh my goodness, is this how the smartest people in the room goose their returns, make the returns work. And those are individual investors that have a different risk tolerance because it's our own money in some ways. But there's no question that CalPERS of the world, the endowment funds of the world, have big, big responsibilities, and they look at things just a little bit differently. And it just is absolutely fascinating. In any event, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I mean, like the CalPERS announcement, what they're doing, this extended, we're probably going to have a protracted period of low interest rates. I mean, this environment is calling to question, you know, kind of fundamental baseline finance knowledge that we've accumulated over decades. It's really a new era for institutional investors, retail investors, companies operating in this, private equity funds themselves. It really is a new era, and it's just fascinating to watch.
Matt, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today on the Becker Private Equity Business Podcast. I know a wide range of subjects from Fed Chairman Powell. We didn't talk much about labor shortages, but to investment opportunities. Is it slowing? Is it picking up? Where are multiples at? And so many issues. Just a pleasure visiting with you today on the Becker Private Equity Business Podcast. Matt Wolf, RSM, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.